Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding, is now in session.
You may be seated. Thank you. Good morning. The first case set for argument is Appeal Number 30353, State of South Dakota versus Absolu. We have Timothy Wrench, who's appearing on behalf of Mr. Absolu, will be arguing, and Matthew Templer, Assistant Attorney General, will be arguing on behalf of the State of South Dakota. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Wrench, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You can proceed.
May it please the court, may it please counsel. I am here today on behalf of Arntzen Absolu asking for a new trial, in essence. Arntzen Absolu was convicted of the murder of three people, a terrible and very heinous murder. And I must say that at the outset of the trial, things did not look good for Mr. Absolu. There was a lot of evidence against him. But as we proceeded through the trial, and as I started to expound upon the defense theory in the cross-examination, and as we examined closely the evidence, things started to look much, much different. And the reason for that is in this particular situation where these killings occurred, there was surveillance video. And the surveillance video showed one of the alleged victims who helped set up the murders under the state's theory, as well as the perpetrator walking down a sidewalk across the street from where a camera was and just up the street from where Thompson Park was, where the first two murders occurred. And it was the state's theory at that point in time that the two people in that video were Dakota Zeiser, who ended up being the third victim in this case, and Arntzen Absolu, who was the defendant. We showed through the evidence that their heights were very, very similar. But at Exhibit 8.1 in the record, you could see the two individuals walk past a post, and it showed a significant height difference between the two, one that was not consistent with just an inch or two or a similar height. The state's main witness against Arntzen Absolu was Shamar Bennett. And Shamar Bennett was really the axle of the wheel, or the hub which held all the spokes together. And what did Shamar Bennett do in this case? Shamar Bennett came in and testified before the jury that Absolu had recruited him to help clean up a murder scene and had also gotten his help to take a body and bury it out in the Black Hills. Bennett ultimately led the authorities to that body. At trial, when Bennett testified, the information that the defense had about Bennett was the substantial statements he'd made. I mean, hundreds of pages of his statements in the transcripts from two very lengthy interviews, which he started out lying quite a bit on, and then after meeting with the state's attorney, Mr. Vargo, changed his tune, acknowledged that he had some part in this, and then took the authorities out to where the body of Dakota Zeiser was. Bennett was also important in the sense that he said Arntzen Absolu essentially confessed to him to killing the first two people in the parking lot and also killing Dakota Zeiser because Dakota wouldn't be able to keep his mouth shut. But what we didn't know at the time of Bennett's testimony in cross-examination was that weeks before the trial, Bennett was in a location where a little baby suffered a skull fracture. He was one of two adults there. And I was able to read some reports about this initially when I inquired of it from the prosecution and could read the initial reports. And I ultimately made the motion after the trial for this information to be preserved so it could be reviewed and so that I could make a motion for a new trial about it. We had no idea about this.
Mr. Wrench, I know you contacted the state after trial to
correct, to
make an inquiry about this. How did you learn about it?
I just heard rumors on the street that this guy had been involved in this, and rather than rather than trying to track down where those came from, I thought I would send an email over to the state and say, is there any truth in this?
And that was all post-trial that you started hearing these rumors?
All post-trial. It was all, it was post-trial.
Like early February, maybe early February-ish. Early February after the January trial, somewhere in there.
You know, I had the email that I got back from Kevin Kroll. I think it might even be
later than that, yeah.
February 1, you know. It was after the trial was finished, and it just was a complete surprise. And when I sent the email, Mr. Kroll, who had previously been a circuit judge, says, you know, I did hear information about this. I remember him possibly being talked about as a person of interest. I don't know that he was a suspect, and we learned this during the witness prep. And I thought he might have said in December of 2022. But the point being, there was no indication of that prior to the trial. The information wasn't available prior to the trial. And what makes this particularly important is we had a specific discovery order about any possible favorable treatment, direct or indirect, for certain matters, including DSS matters, whether it was formal or informal. And when I mentioned this to Mr. Kroll, I think it was over the weekend that he offered to let me look at the reports. I looked at them immediately and then stepped in and made my motions. But those reports indicated two separate days where this little baby had trouble, been taken to the hospital on one day and then sent home and then taken to the hospital or the ambulance came or something like the next day, and the baby had a skull fracture. And there was reference in the reports that I saw to a doorknob or something on a closet or something like that having a mark on it in this house.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you, because that information is in the record.
Yes.
And because we have limited time, I'd like you to be able to address, because the circuit court ruled that this should have been turned over, but then found it wasn't, or at least found that it wasn't material. Maybe I don't misrepresent the ruling. But I'd like you to address the materiality issue with regard to this information, and it would be really helpful if you could explain to us specifically how you would have intended to use this information in cross-examination.
Be happy to do it. So what the circuit court did in this case was found that that information was irrelevant because the testimony of the grand jury and the trial were consistent in certain regards. It's our position here that the court did not weigh as to how that would have affected the verdict. And I thought about this, how I would have used that information. I think my entire cross-examination of Bennett would have been different. And I think I would have asked him, what's important to you in life? What do you value? What is consideration to you? And would it be important to you to still be around your children? Would it be important to you not to be charged or even suspected of a murder and of receiving beneficial information from DSS? And what I would try to show is that the way that he was not charged and the way that this thing was delayed was of a benefit to him, was consideration to him, and had value to him.
So there was, and I'm going to interrupt too, please pardon me.
Sure.
But so this event happened late-ish November before your January 9 trial date. So a couple months-ish in that area.
Yes, sir.
But on this topic of impeachment, you know, I've read, of course, your cross-examination of Mr. Bennett. He was impeached.
Well, he was.
He was heavily impeached. And he was impeached with, among other things, an immunity agreement that wasn't just the specter of consideration or favorable treatment. It was absolutely favorable treatment. I mean, he helped get rid of a body, under your theory, even at a minimum. And, well, I know you think perhaps more, but how would this impeachment fundamentally differ or change? In thinking about your answer, I know that you also impeached him with some other uncharged conduct or made an effort to inquire about a charge, a probation violation, things like that had gone away. and suggested also strongly in that way that he was receiving a benefit from that. Would this be along those same lines?
I think this is even more. First of all, he denied receiving benefits under oath in the direct examination. He said he did not get any benefits or consideration. The benefit or consideration...
But of course he did, and I don't hate to interrupt, but of course he did. We all know he did, and well, he cleared that up on redirect.
No, right? I agree with that. I'm just making a falsus and who knows thought when he denies that. So then, what consideration did he get if what he says is true? He's not charged with accessory after the fact to murder. Okay? Well, that's a serious deal. But if he is suspected of killing somebody prior to his testimony, and because he is slated to testify, this investigation slows down, and they don't look into him, then he gets additional consideration in that he's not looked at for an actual murder. And think about these shaken baby cases. I've done two of them, and the party line is the last adults with the baby are the ones who commit the abusive head trauma. And here they were blaming toddlers, and the doctor said that that wasn't the case.
So your Brady theory, to be clear, and I think we've established this, your Brady theory is not the exculpatory evidence variety of Brady in that due process context. It's the impeachment variety. So with impeachment, so in other words, you're not trying to prove factually he killed this child within this trial.
No.
So isn't there a limit at some point at which you're stuck with his answers for the most part? He says no. So you could say, and I don't know if this is even admissible, but you could say something along the lines, you would do it much better than me, but you could say something along these lines, you know, isn't it true that you were present when a child passed away? Yes. And you haven't been charged? No. You don't want to be charged? No. Do you think your testimony here today is going to help you avoid your charges? I don't know. Whatever you get, aren't you done then?
No. And here's why. It's not what he says. It's how he says it. It's how the jury views it. And evidence is favorable where it creates a reasonable doubt that did not otherwise exist. If he gets all hinky on the stand and shaky on the stand and very nervous and the jury picks that up and they think that that brings into question his credibility, you get to attack his credibility. And remember
this. Please understand, I don't want to minimize by saying that's it. I'm just trying to kind of define the parameters of what this would look like in visualizing this. So please forgive me if I didn't mean to minimize it.
No, I appreciate the point. And what I'm saying is this, is when you're cross-examining somebody, impeachment is a lot more than, oh, you said this before and you say this now. Impeachment is really asking questions to show what a person has to gain about something.
Do you have is there a theory or an evidentiary theory that would allow you to get into, and this is really maybe what I'm driving at, is there an evidentiary theory that would allow you to get into more than that, potentially? Facts, things like that.
Depends on what he says. If he says something that opens it up to impeachment by contradiction, that could open it up. It also depends on me having the information in advance and seeing how it ties into the other information.
I understand that.
And considering that information in connection with what he says so that we can go through and try to cross-examine it. But to use the word impeachment, I know there's this statement that impeachment is not quite enough, but impeachment is a lot more than just calling into question what a person says. It's showing what they have to gain. You look at State versus Wiegers, says that when you're impeaching the crucial witness in the case, you have wide latitude. And when we think about what this is all about, looking at the court's instruction on 47 on how to gauge a witness's credibility, something like this, a hope, is what it can come down to. You know, the position here...
Counsel, I'm sorry. So what hope, I guess I'm still trying to understand, you think that he would have in this scenario. So he the immunity agreement he assigned that he was provided for the existing potential charges, sure, had an exclusion for any violent crimes or violent acts. So you're thinking, is it your thought that he would be thinking he would not be charged with a killing a child, if that were in fact the case, because of his testimony in another matter? I mean, I'm trying to understand.
Not that at all. His hope is that if he continues doing what he's doing with the state, then they continue not looking at him seriously as a suspect in the case. And the reason we get into hope, I know that ordinarily you don't worry about nebulous hopes and all that stuff, but this discovery order specifically says it, that they are required to provide to me evidence of consideration. Absolutely anything, whether bargained for or not, which arguably could be of value or use to the witness. They didn't object to this regarding potential social services matters, among other things. So that was in the order. They were obligated to give that. The state knew of this in, at the very least, of December of 2022. The state's attorney and I had a good relationship, and we talked a lot about information. Every time she talked to a witness, if something changed or came up, we would talk, and then I would be able to use that. And when you look at her affidavit, she spoke to Shamar Bennett about these very things, and she said he looked like he was sad about it. But then when you comport that with what Shamar Bennett did in the criminal investigation, the police wanted to talk to him. He exercised his right to silence and counsel, and he's speaking with the prosecutor about this very matter during the witness preparation, as you can see in the affidavit of the prosecutor, which is Exhibit 2 attached to their response to the motion for new trial. And all the while, I have no idea. I'm going in. He's saying he gets no benefit. I point out all these charges that have been dismissed and all these favorable things that happened. And then all along, this guy's sitting here and they're trying to search his phones, get his phone records and all of this stuff. You even note in those affidavits that on January 13th, I think, was when his girlfriend's phone was seized to be searched. That is 3 days into the trial. And given the relationship that I had with Roxanne Hammond, she would tell me when something new came up about the witnesses. It's something.
So, Mr. Ringer, I'm going to stop you there. I don't know if there's other questions from the court, but obviously you'll have some time for rebuttal. But
I've got one, but I can. Sure. So I just want, you know, the testimony of Bennett at the grand jury and at trial are similar. There aren't huge divergencies in the testimony. So, and your response to that is, you know, the claim is, well, there's no prejudice. Your response is, the prejudice comes in my ability to impeach him through cross-examination about an additional benefit. Is that the crux of it?
Correct. At trial. And when we look at the motions hearing where I brought this up first with the court, the circuit court judge asked the prosecutor, and this is page 14 of a transcript that's on February 23rd, 2023, the judge says, but it seems to me that if somebody is a suspect, then at the same time testifies as a witness, wouldn't that mean, I mean, aside from whether or not that's admissible for impeachment purposes or not, isn't that Brady material? Shouldn't that be turned over because it could go to the motivation of the witness while testifying? While testifying. It's not about the motivation of the witness prior to that point in time. This information was available before he testified. So when you're looking at what motivation needs to be delved into and scooped out and laid into the sunlight and exposed to the jury in the light of day, it's what is there while he's testifying. This was there, and I didn't have a chance to ask about it.
Thank you.
Thank you for giving me extra time.
Mr. Templer, you can proceed with your argument.
Mr. Templer, I'm going to, if I can, get right into it. Your time's limited, too. And it's mainly because Mr. Wrench ended on a point that I wanted to ask about. And that is the circuit judge's determination that this is favorable evidence and therefore should have been disclosed. And separate and apart from the discussion that we might have about how material it was, I want to address that because you've argued that you have a contrary view. Can we review that?
I think you can.
You didn't appeal it, and you didn't notice it for review, and I don't know whether we can or we can't.
I think you can, Your Honor, because with Mr. Wrench filing his notice of appeal and challenging the court's determination on the new trial motion as a whole puts the entire Brady analysis under the microscope here. But I also think you can look at this court's decision in Cahiga, where you had the initial determination by the circuit court that these statements by Cahiga's wife on the prison phone calls were adoptive admissions. This court said that the circuit court was right to allow those, but for the wrong reasons. They weren't adoptive admissions. They weren't even hearsay because it provided context to Cahiga's answers, and so they were admissible nonetheless, but the court determined that it was on a different theory than the circuit court reached. So I think same situation here, because all three elements of Brady, which is favorability, suppression, and materiality, have to be proven. All of them can be reviewed, but obviously we're not disputing the suppression element of that since these reports weren't turned over. But as I've stated in my brief, the circuit court was wrong to conclude that these reports were favorable in the first place, because favorable evidence for impeachment is things like immunity agreements, cooperation agreements, inconsistent statements to law enforcement, or promises of leniency. It's not a witness's nebulous expectation of hope that they might receive leniency. There has to be some agreement between that witness and the prosecution that they are even considering giving them favorable treatment in return for their testimony.
Well, Mr. Wrench says, though, that that discovery order is broader than that. I mean, I know you're focused right now on Brady, but the discovery order does seem to be broader than just are there agreements in place. But, you know, it seems to go to expectations of the defendant. Would you agree with that?
I agree that it's broader, Your Honor, and in hindsight, it's probably too broad, and it should have been objected to from the state's perspective, but it wasn't.
It wasn't. So is the information discoverable under that order?
I think if you look at it at a surface level, yes, but when you look at the practicalities and kind of loop it in with Brady about we don't know what's going on in a witness's mind, so if there's no communication, it's kind of hard to turn around and just say, well, this person might be expecting hope versus another. And I believe the U.S. Supreme Court has said multiple times that Brady isn't designed to fault prosecutors if they essentially guess wrong on something of whether it should
be. But going back to that discovery order, you're really, if that information should have been produced, irrespective of Brady, you're really just talking about was it prejudicial or would it have made a difference in the outcome of the case? That's really what we're talking about, aren't we?
At that point, yes, Your Honor, but I still believe when you have to tie the Brady analysis with that discovery analysis to kind of get the full picture about why it's not really practical.
But aren't they two separate bases?
They're two separate things, but they both go to the right to a fair trial. So I mean, that's where there's the interconnection and giving the defendant a chance to exercise his right to confront and cross-examine witnesses and with the appropriate information to do that. And coming to the materiality part of it, I think Justice Kern hit the nail on the head. Shamar's testimony was consistent from grand jury to trial, and I think it's important to look at the actual timeline of how the case progressed to see why there's no problem with him testifying how he did ultimately and with this information not being able to be used by the defense.
But here's the point that Mr. Wrench is making that's the concern. That I agree, the testimony at grand jury and trial appear to be relatively consistent, but he's saying that Bennett is one of two suspects in a murder, and he wants to cross-examine about the potentiality that he's receiving some form of benefit because he hadn't been charged at that point. And so, you know, how much would he have been able to get into on cross, I think, is what Justice Salter was driving at. Aren't you stuck with the answer that you get from the witness about that incident? How far could he have gone? And that's where we get to the crux of, was he prejudiced? Assume that it was that this should have been turned over, hypothetically. All right, what's the prejudice? And that's where Mr. Wrench is arguing, okay, well, the prejudice is I could have used this to impeach him and reduce his credibility in front of the jury.
Sure. So a couple of answers to that, Your Honor. So first on the prejudice on just was he could have used it to impeach him. The Eighth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, and the Second Circuit have all talked about situations where it ultimately comes down to the impeachment with a witness where some information wasn't disclosed. And when their credibility is already shown to be suspect or questionable in front of the jury, those courts have found that there's no prejudice. And I think the great quote comes from the Amil case from the Second Circuit that I cite, where they say impeachment evidence, quote, is not material when it merely furnishes an additional basis on which to impeach a witness whose credibility has already been shown to be questionable. That's exactly what happened here. Mr. Wrench was able to question Shamar about his immunity agreement. He painted it when Shamar said he was receiving no benefit that he was receiving other benefits, and as Justice Salter was talking about earlier, that was corrected on redirect to mention the immunity agreement itself. He was also able to get into the deferred prosecution for some charges, and I think this is where the timeline was coming in. I was talking about that the murders of Ashley and Charles happened on August 24th. The murder of Dakota happened the evening of the 24th into the early morning of the 25th. Beginning or middle of September is Shamar's first interview with law enforcement where he lies saying they were burying drugs out in the woods. The second interview happens on September 21st where he eventually comes clean and leads detectives to the body of Dakota. And then from that point on, that is consistent with he helped Absolute dump Dakota's body, dump the bloody chair and bloody rug from Maddie Ziegler's apartment. That follows through his grand jury testimony on January 6, 2021, and his trial testimony in January of 2023.
If I'm understanding Mr. Wrench's argument, though, and he can correct me if I'm not, but in his position, he may not be all that comforted by the fact that the testimony at the grand jury was the same as it was at trial. Because how hard is that, he might argue. No one's cross-examining Shamar Bennett at the grand jury. That's the nature of the proceeding. The only opportunity a defense lawyer has to impeach him is at the trial. I think that's what he was emphasizing when he said that. So how, you know, that may fall flat. I mean, is that remarkable that he was, how hard is that to testify the same way that you did at the grand jury when you weren't impeached?
I take your point on that, Justice Salter, but I think when you look at the full picture of the cross-examination that he did get to do, there's no question that the jury had it in front of him that Shamar was potentially a shaky witness on credibility grounds. Like I said, he brought up the deferred prosecution that came about 3 months after he led officers to the body and about a month before his grand jury testimony. He brought up that Shamar was a convicted felon and that these other felonies had gone away, but I think it's really important to look at, by my count, across Mr. Wrench's cross and recross of Shamar, some iteration of the word lie, like lied, liar, untrue, was said 62 times. So the jury was well aware of Shamar's credibility, and they could assess that in determining this case and deciding what weight to give his testimony. And I don't think this other information would have changed that, and I think that comes directly from the Supreme Court's decision in Wong versus Belmontes, that even if Mr. Wrench could have used that, the analysis has to be the totality of the evidence that was presented, but also the evidence that the state would have used to meet this other evidence the defense would have used. So what would that have been? Shamar's grand jury testimony would have come in under 801 D1 or D1B as a prior consistent statement to rebut an allegation of recent fabrication. You would also have the detectives involved in the child death case would then come in and explain why that what path that investigation took and why they determined that Shamar was not a suspect and not involved, which also creates a 403 issue because then we're starting a mini trial on a completely separate homicide in an already complicated triple murder case that spanned 3 weeks.
I want to ask you a little bit about that, because this additional information is unique from anything else that was used for impeachment at the time of trial. I mean, you got maybe a suspect in the death of a baby. That's totally different than I'm a convicted felon. Selling drugs, whatever it might be. That's a different category, and you get that information in front of a jury. This guy killed a baby or suspected of killing a baby. That may change the whole complexion in terms of how maybe this guy killed these other three too. So I raise that in the context of there's also some impropriety in there from the standpoint of we're starting to get into this character. How much of that gets in, and how does the court handle that information?
Well, just as the circuit court did here, that information doesn't get in at all because it's purely character evidence at that point. It's showing, well, Shamar might have a violent tendency, and so if he killed this baby, he's capable of killing these other three in cold-blooded murder. But also I think that comes back to the problem that I pointed out in the brief, that there was no disclosure of third-party perpetrator evidence Yet, in closing, Mr. Wrench specifically focused on Shamar as being the killer. I don't believe that's commenting on the evidence, as he says in his reply brief. That's a third-party perpetrator defense when you're naming a specific person.
But, counsel, even if that were an issue, I mean, there is a body of case law. Let's assume that wasn't an issue. He's obviously in this knee-deep. So it would make sense that the defense could talk about his involvement here. But as far as what you can admit, even when you do have a third-party perpetrator, those are still rules are still governed by the rules of evidence.
Correct, Your Honor.
What we're getting at here.
Yes, that's exactly where the circuit court went, and I think the circuit court got it right on that point. Is it was easy to deal with the 609 issue because there was no conviction. The 404B issue, it's relevant under the first prong of that analysis because it does go to a bias and an interest, and so I don't have any quibbles with the court with that situation. But it's the substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice. Essentially, if this information would have been able to be put in front of the jury, then we have the Lassiter and Moeller 1 issues where it's just a violent propensity. There's no connection or similarities between the victims in either cases, and there's no connection or similarities to how the crimes were committed themselves. So that is nothing but propensity evidence, and that couldn't come in. Even if it did, there is overwhelming evidence that Absolu is the one who murdered Ashley Nagy, Charles Redwillow, and Dakota Zeiser. And it's even disconnected from Shamar's involvement. And I think the biggest piece of evidence to look at is Exhibit 57, which is the cell phone data report from the FBI. That shows that before, during, and after the murders, Absolu's phone was being serviced by the cell towers that covered Maddie Ziegler's apartment, where we see Dakota Zeiser heading immediately after being released from jail, the area of Thompson Park, and the area of Rapid Creek where the murder weapon was eventually found. Connect that with the photographs found on Absolu's phone of the black handgun that he was looking to buy, that Maddie Ziegler said he threatened her with a black handgun the morning of the murders, and that black handgun was found in his vehicle when his car was searched in New York. You also have the pictures of the black and silver Smith & Wesson that was found on his phone. That's similar to the murder weapon that was found in Rapid Creek, and Antonio Cadena testified that he had seen Absolu possess a black and silver Smith & Wesson earlier in the summer. But I think the real kicker of what was found on his phone was after the time of the murders, but before he asked Shamar for help, there's photos in his internet cache that he was searching for how to make lye. What's lye used for in a nefarious purpose? Destroying a body. So he looked for that, and then he looked for help from Shamar. And I think at the end of the day, when this court looks at the totality of the evidence that was presented to the jury, the totality of the evidence when it would include the Wong versus Belamonte's evidence that the state would respond with had this information come in, there's one conclusion to reach. Absolu would still have been found guilty of the murders of Ashley Nagy, Charles Redwillow, and Dakota Zeiser. And for these reasons, and the reasons I state in my brief, we ask this court to affirm his convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Templin. Mr. Wrench, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you. First of all, if the evidence was as overwhelming as the state says, then how could they suffer prejudice by this other information coming in? The jury should be able to weigh it. It is true that
too late. I mean, we can't go back and, it's too late at that point. I don't know how you would conceive of that.
My point is that if it's as overwhelming as they say, how can it be said to be prejudicial to have this additional information in? That's my point. Not that they know that now. If it's so overwhelming, then how can evidence of what Bennett might receive or has received in connection with the child death investigation prejudice the state? Secondly, even if it could prejudice the state, State versus Loesky, there are limiting instructions. State versus Will, as I cite in my brief, this stuff comes in for a different purpose rather than the truth of the matter asserted. So there are ways to deal with that and tell the jury that they can use it to evaluate his credibility, but can't.
I've got to kind of get this straight in my mind. Because we had this discussion with Mr. Templar, and I see this principally as an impeachment issue. I really don't, and maybe I'm wrong. I don't know how the substantive evidence comes in to in an effort to prove that he killed this child.
I don't intend to assert that that's
should happen. And I'm not saying you are, but am I right that your argument still is focused on, hey, this is how I would have impeached him, almost as you started, you know, with your answer to Justice Manning.
What does he have to gain? What does he have to gain? And how does that come to bear on his testimony before the jury at that moment? How does he answer it? If he's such a shaky witness or a potentially shaky witness, as the state says, and the jury was able to see it, what happens if he's shaky on this too? What if that goes into the idea of whether or not they can believe it? You know, as we look at impeachment, we have State versus Uyghurs, and we also have State versus Pact, that cross-examination directed towards revealing possible biases, prejudice, or ulterior motives of the witness as they may relate directly to the issues and personalities in the case at hand. The personality in this case at hand is Shamar Bennett's personality, and it's how he responds. And my point about if the case is overwhelming, as the state says, that there's no prejudice to the state, is if the evidence is strong as they claim, then why can't I ask Shamar Bennett?
Well, his prejudice analysis is in reference to 404B, and that's essentially talking about this idea that you might delve into trying to prove that there are that he's outside of other acts. You know, that you've already acknowledged, I think, that that's not where you were going.
No,
your argument is that I didn't have the opportunity to impeach him on these points, and the jury didn't have a chance to see how he responded to the impeachment.
Exactly.
And it's possible that he responded to the impeachment in a way that made the jury say, I don't believe this guy.
Correct. And he was a critical and crucial witness for the state. He was the axle that kept the spokes together. And because of that, we have a right to question him to show the reasons that there are scant reasons to believe him. And that's really the basis of a trial, especially when he's trying to contend that he's getting no benefits.
So let's go back to that point. So assuming that I think I've got your argument correct, which is, you know, this might have been the tipping point, the straw that broke the camel's back. We don't know because it didn't get presented. Mr. Templar makes some pretty compelling arguments that there's a lot in this record with respect to this witness, Mr. Bennett, that says this can't possibly have been the straw that broke the camel's back. Tell me why he's wrong.
My comment to that is, when we look at the gun he was speaking about, I proved in the evidence that the gun that was in Absolute's phone that was next to the distinct black gun that was found in his car, it could not have been the gun that was found in the crick. Also, as to this phone information, the FBI expert testified he couldn't pinpoint the exact location of Arntzen Absolute and couldn't place him exactly in Thompson Park. So when he's talking about these things that are so strong, there is a different way to view those. Also, if it was as overwhelming as the state contends and it was so clear, I've been in cases where there's been overwhelming evidence and the jury comes in very, very quickly and convicts. But when you have a jury processing this over 2 days, when you're looking at a 2.5-week trial, many of those days we were not in trial because of the schedule of things, that this long deliberation of the jury would tend to show that they were chewing on something.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Rich.
Thank you for having me. I love this courtroom, and it's an honor to be here.
Thank you, counsel, for both of your arguments. The case is now submitted. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.